Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. Stay ahead of all the big games in the best league in the world, the Premier League. With the latest odds, form guides, expert opinions and more, the fans are the players at Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com, 18+, begambleaware.org. T's and C's apply.
This is a Game Day podcast from TalkSport.
Hello and welcome to the Game Day podcast from TalkSport with me, Sam Matterface, the assistant editor of The Mirror, Darren Lewis, and TalkSport's European football expert, Kevin Hatchard. Coming up, the big transfer targets. Why are clubs honing in on these particular talents? Where does Raheem Sterling fit in at Chelsea? And why are Manchester United so desperate to seal a deal for Frankie de Jong? Also, a look at the Lionesses before the start of the European Championships, which is live on TalkSport. And do we really care that Jack Grealish was living La Vida Loca in Las Vegas? It's all on the Game Day podcast from TalkSport.
This is Game Day.
No Alex Crook today, but Kevin Hatchard is here, and so is Darren Lewis. And look, all of us are trained journalists. We love a good story, and we're all thinking this morning as we woke up, if only we knew that all you had to do was send a little tweet out and gaslight a little chief executive of a football club, sit down at the pub at the end of their road, and eventually they would just turn up and spill the beans to you. That's all you have to do, apparently. Richard Arnold, the Manchester United CEO, was the victim of a planned protest outside his house. He got wind of it, heard that they were meeting in the pub beforehand, so just went down the pub, had a pint with them and chatted through some of the big issues of the day. I must admit, I can't work out, Darren, whether or not this is a proper bit of PR skullduggery on the part of Manchester United or a piece of genuine human connection from Richard Arnold. But whatever, it is a belting story. Fans plan protest at house of new CEO. He finds out that they're going to meet in the pub and he goes to the pub. Brilliant. I love it.
I love it too. I think it's superb PR on his part. I think it's a great move to head them off at the pass, as it were. It reminded me very much of Kevin Keegan on the steps of St. James's Park talking to fans upset over the sale of Andy Cole all those years ago, in terms of deciding, I'm not going to wait for a sanitized press release or some kind of official line. I'm just going to go and talk to them man to man. And I think, in some respects, it's that kind of dose of reality stroke common sense that Manchester United need in their approach to their fan base. And the disappointment from the club's point of view is that it was leaked out in an attempt to embarrass Richard Arnold. I would never say, I've said this on the show before, I would never say that somebody giving us information is a bad thing.
No.
Because our job is information. Our job is news. If somebody wants to tell us, I'd be a hypocrite to sit here and say that the fans are wrong to leak it. I think they were wrong to leak it in an attempt to embarrass Richard Arnold, when all he is guilty of doing is being honest and open and trying to plot a way forward in conjunction with the fans.
Yeah, I mean, what I would say is the only thing that worried me is that he said they've burned through so much cash that Manchester United can't upgrade their stadium or their training ground. He said, we've blown an enormous amount of money. You can't go to our training ground and say, show me where that £1 billion is here. And he is right, Kevin, but he has been part of the Manchester United machine since 2007. For Christ's sakes, he's been in control of their business operation since 2013. So the idea that he's talking about burning through £1 billion, actually, it's partly on his watch.
Yeah, that's true. But a lot of people will focus on the job that Ed Woodward did before that. And I think rightly so, because one of the things I thought was interesting about what Richard Arnold said to the fans was about the kind of involvement of Woodward in transfers and the fact that he actually is going to step away. He's going to let John Murtough do his thing. He's going to let Erik ten Hag do his thing. And he will give them the money. There is a specific budget, it seems, for this summer. I thought it was a good thing that he met them. I don't like the idea of fans going to a chief exec's house. No. I don't think that's acceptable. I don't think that's the way to protest. I understand the anger. I've said before, I don't agree with the way the Glazers took the club over. I don't agree with leveraged buyouts in general. But I don't think you can have a situation where you're threatening to go to an executive's house. That's not right. So I applaud the fact that he had that contact with the fans. I thought it was a shame it was leaked. I think that was probably always going to happen, sadly, in the social media age. There was always going to be one of the people in the meeting who thought, oh, this would be a laugh. I'll sneakily, you know, film this.
I don't care
this.
That it was leaked. I don't care that it was leaked, really. I actually think it's quite I think it's just such a great story that we should know about it. I sort of kind of feel like this is maybe Manchester United doing something they haven't done for a long time, which is engaging with their supporters on a human level. And do you know what? About time to.
I look up and down the Premier League and I think to myself, would you see anyone at Arsenal doing that? Not really. I mean, I know one or two people have held those fans forums things, but this is very different. Going to the pub for a pint and saying, look, guys, off the record, this is what the situation is. There are a number of other chairmen at a number of other clubs that I would not even countenance the idea of them doing it. And, you know, if anyone from any of our outlets or us were to be in receipt of information like that, we would use that information. So I'm not going to criticise the fans for leaking it. But I just think it's a mistake because there was a real opportunity to build a relationship with the guy. And you have to wonder whether he would agree to do it again, knowing that someone within that circle would be likely to do that again. One last thing on that. I agree with you, Kevin. I think sometimes we tiptoe around it because it's Manchester United, but there are a number of things that they've done in the name of protest that have crossed the line. You know, all of us understand the frustration of the club, of the fans with the direction that the club has taken. But you can't go to chief executives' houses. You can't trash Old Trafford. You can't do some of the things that some of the United fans have done.
You can't threaten the life of the captain, for example.
You can't. You simply can't. And I'm sorry, but I don't care how passionately you feel about the club. There are some areas where you are crossing the line if you do that kind of thing. And it is our job to be clear about that.
But there must be a mechanism for them to protest, I think. And yeah, certainly absolutely. When you're Manchester United and they've been as badly run, and look, they have been badly run because the CEO has just admitted that they've been badly run for the last 10 years, then you can understand the frustrations of the fans and actually getting to the point where actually they're getting... It's got to a crucial breaking point. They need to get their point across. They need to try and force change. Maybe that will happen. One of the things that might change is personnel over the course of the summer. We're going to look at Raheem Sterling, Gabriel Jesus, Darwin Nunez, before we get into the Lionesses a little bit later on. All about those players and where tactically they fit into their potential new clubs. But we're going to start with Frankie de Jong. Yes, let's look at some of those transfers and what they'll bring to their new clubs, because we've had a lot of big clubs either acquiring or getting close to acquiring big name talent, or even going all in on one particular player, just identifying that that player is going to be their summer target and nothing else. And that certainly seems to be the case with Manchester United and Frankie de Jong. Why is he so crucial to Erik ten Hag? Why are they desperate, Kevin, to sign him?
He's a very clever player, for a start. He's very important in build-up, which is going to be something that's very important to Erik ten Hag as a Manchester United coach. So what he's able to do is he can either break the lines with a clever pass, or what he's very, very good at doing is drawing a defensive player onto him and then taking them out of the game, either with a cleverly disguised pass or he might ghost past them. He kind of plays that role in a way that not many players do, actually. I do think he would need a ball winner in there alongside him. That's not really what he does. But he's the kind of player that can genuinely dictate the tempo of a team and of a game. And he can structure their attacks in a way that they haven't been able to do in the season just gone. They were terrible in build-up in the season just gone. And it's such an important part of the game in general. And it's a really important part of what Erik ten Hag is going to want to do. He played a key role in that Ajax team that was so successful domestically, but also got to the semi-finals of the Champions League in 2019. And apart from an incredible comeback by Tottenham, they would have got to the final that year. So I can understand why they want him. The situation's complex because Barcelona, in an ideal world, would not sell him. Xavi is a big fan. He's a player that can be a big part of their rebuilds. But financially, they might need to sanction the deal just to try and balance the books and bring other players in. So there's still a lot of moving parts to this, but I can understand why Ten Hag wants to work with him again.
Yeah, he's the kind of player that can take the ball under intense pressure. And in the Premier League, when you're being relentlessly pressed by some of the bigger teams in the league, that is a key facet of the game and something that Manchester United in particular weren't very good at last year. He can find the killer pass. He doesn't mind taking the ball in tight circumstances. And he looks like he'll be the keystone to the system that Erik ten Hag wants to play. But I think Barcelona thought that he was going to be as well. And that hasn't quite worked out. Despite the fact that Xavi is a fan, he hasn't had the best of times there. But whether or not they get a deal down might depend more on whether or not Barcelona sanction the sale at a particular price, because they are in a parlous state financially. I think it was just the other day that they agreed to sell off 49.9% of their future shirt sales, pretty much. I mean, that is pretty worrying. They are desperately in need of cash, Darren. So maybe that might be the reason that De Jong ends up moving on.
You're right about all of that, but if I were a United fan, I'd be a little bit concerned. While you've been talking, I was just looking here because it rang a bell for me, something I'd read a few weeks ago, where De Jong basically said he didn't want to go. He said, "I'm already at my dream club. I prefer to stay with Barcelona." He was interviewed with our colleagues at ESPN, and he said, "Look, it's my dream club. Also, from a very young age, I've never regretted my choice." Now, could be old-fashioned, but I think if you're looking to change the culture at a club and you want to rebuild, you need players who are committed to what you are trying to do. And it sounds very much as though United are throwing money at this guy in the hope that he will agree to change his mind. And for me, that's a bit of a red flag early doors. And I don't know, I think you've got to have people who don't feel they're doing you a favour if you're trying to go in the right direction, rather than players who are taking the step down and would rather be at the club that is pushing them out of the door. There is a lot about this one that worries me.
I think there's an element of positioning here, though, as well. I think he wants to send the message to the Barcelona fans, look, I'm committed to this club, because he knows this might not go through. He knows that if Barcelona don't get the money for him that they want or need, he might still be a Barcelona player. So the one thing he doesn't want to be seen to be doing is making eyes at Ten Hag and Manchester United, so that then he gets grief from the Barcelona fans if he ends up staying. I do think he's genuine about enjoying his time at Barcelona. It has been a very dysfunctional football club on and off the pitch. That changed in the second part of last season with the work that Xavi did and the players they were able to bring in the winter window. The worry for them as a football club is that they haven't learnt anything. Joan Laporta, the president, is already talking about trying to match Paris Saint-Germain and Manchester City and compete for the biggest signings if they can, you know, sell off the merchandising and the licensing, or at least 49.9% of those. The debts are enormous. They really are. And so Barcelona, whether they like it or not, are going to have to find a different way. But I disagree with Darren slightly. Normally I would in terms of commitment, but I think he could be such an important signing for them that initial reluctance. And look, he's worked really well with Ten Hag before, so I don't think it would be a problem necessarily. I think that can be overcome because I think he would bring so much to that team and to that club.
Okay, just a question for you. If you feel that it's an element of positioning, then surely say nothing. rather than say one thing, say something one way or the other. Because and then when the deal is done, you can talk about the fact that you didn't want to leave, they pushed you out the door. But for me, I just think messaging is so important. And when you're a club like Manchester United, the size of Manchester United, you should... I remember when Jaap Stam, they wanted to sign Jaap Stam. Jaap Stam wanted to come. They talk about it. I think he said himself, you know, he wasn't interested in the money. He wanted to come. He wanted to play for Ferguson. He wanted to play at Old Trafford. They are such a massive club, United, that you want players who want to be at the club.
They are.
Not players who say, I'm at my dream club already. I don't want to go. I just think it doesn't send out the right message for a club that's trying to change its culture.
They are, but they're in a different position now than they were at the end of the 90s, the beginning of the 2000s. They're a club that actually need to rebuild and need to convince players to buy into the project.
Absolutely.
And that is something that maybe Erik ten Hag can do with Frankie de Jong. It's getting a little bit more difficult with some of the Dutch players, though, isn't it? Because Jurrien Timber, for example, was expected to be another one of those who would sign for Erik ten Hag, but he's been convinced out of it by Louis van Gaal, who systematically seems to be going around and telling everybody who's anyone in Dutch football, don't do it. They're a basket case of a club.
Well, this is a really interesting thing as well, because I think this is going to really inform what happens in the transfer market. We have a really odd situation in that we have a World Cup halfway through the season. And so players are thinking, right, if I go there and don't play in the opening 3 months of the season, I'm not going to play for my national team. If Jurrien Timber goes to Old Trafford and plays five Premier League games, Van Gaal will just go, well, you're a good player, but you're not playing, so I can't put you in my team. Whereas if he stays at Ajax, plays regularly, plays well, he's got much better team, much better chance of being in that team come the first game of the World Cup for them.
So could that mean that January ends up being almost a bigger transfer window than usual because people will wait till after the World Cup before making those moves?
I think so. I think we'll get that flurry of deals afterwards because we always get somebody does well in World Cup and they get a big move that they wouldn't normally have got. And I think that will be accelerated to some extent.
Okay, let's
talk. Also, I think as far as Ten Hag is concerned, I know he's done fine things at Ajax and I know you'll be able to expand on that, Kevin, but I kind of think United and Van de Beek, the jury's out for the first 6 months of the season. I wonder if players are looking to see whether they are going in the right direction before they go. Whereas everyone knows what you get from a Liverpool, from a City, Chelsea obviously being champions of Europe, Spurs are going in the right direction under Conte, but you don't quite know whether Ten Hag and United are going to be a good fit. So outside of the Dutch players who know what he can bring, other players are not quite so sure. And that's why big players aren't even considering the biggest players aren't considering United as an option right now.
Yeah, and you've got Van Gaal whispering in every Dutch player's ear, don't do it. Actually, he's not whispering.
He's only saying what the fans are saying. The fans are basically saying that they're a mess. So I don't think it's bad blood or a grudge.
Well, I think
he's saying they've been so focused on money, which has been the case. You talk about Richard Arnold, that they've not focused on the team. So players are going there. Van de Beek played 175 games, I think it was, for Ajax.
Yeah.
He went to United. He didn't kick a ball in anger. He clearly did once or twice, but you know, he was a fringe player. Now he's at Everton. So I can see why Van Halen's saying, I want players who are playing regular first team football to go to Qatar.
Yeah, I made a mistake there. I said he's whispering in everybody's ear. He's not. He's picked up a megaphone and shouting it at everyone. Whatever you do, don't go to Manchester United. Fabio Vieira has signed on the dotted line at Arsenal. What is he going to bring to their midfield? Who is he? He's 22 years of age. He was at Porto last season. He was the European Under-21 Championship player of the tournament a couple of years ago. And he was essentially the most creative player in Portugal, Kevin, producing more assists and expected assists per game than any other player in the division.
He's really good fun. He's a proper entertainer. And I think he's going to be a breath of fresh air. I think he's somebody who fits into that growing group of Arsenal players who are so technically gifted, who make things happen. I think he'll slot in really nicely to that three behind the front man. I think he'll be good cover and competition for Ødegaard because they didn't really have anyone like him. So when he wasn't in the team, that made a bit of a difference. He's somebody that showed up in the big games in Portugal last season. He was a big part of Porto grabbing back that Primeira Liga title. As you say, he's done well at youth level for Portugal. He's done well at youth level at club competition as well, played ever so well in the youth league for Porto before he made that senior breakthrough. I know people will look at it and say, well, he hasn't played a huge amount of senior football, but what he has played has been very impressive.
Yeah, and Darren, they do need someone who is a little bit more creative in that midfield because a lot rested on the shoulders of Martin Ødegaard last season. Gabriel Jesus is another one that they are looking at. How do they transform those issues in front of goal? Because he's not a prolific goal scorer, is he? But is the problem actually that Arsenal haven't created enough chances, or is it that they haven't converted them? I sort of think it's between the two, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a bit between the two. It's interesting, actually, because clearly we know the market they're shopping in. And if they do well next season, it will quite literally be like watching Brazil. Because if you look through the side, there are so many of Jesus' compatriots there. It's quite ironic, actually, because you're right about the fact that they don't create enough and they don't convert enough. But for me, there is far too little steel in that team as well. There isn't really the platform to build on. Because, you know, you can win games 1-0, you know, as long as you're keeping the back door shut. But Arsenal really don't know how to do that on a regular basis. Against the smaller teams, they can. Against the bigger teams, people will point to victory over a Chelsea side that were basically marking time to the end of the season and a Man United side that were opening the door to everyone last season. So I don't really consider those wins. But I think that Vieira is a wonderful player, a really good player for the future. I know they're trying to sign the left centre half as well. Kevin, you may know about a bit more about him. But I think as far as Arsenal are concerned, it's converting goals. The problem with Jesus is that Spurs are sniffing around him as well. And this is going to be a problem Arsenal will have on many occasions because Spurs can offer him Champions League football, whereas Arsenal can't. And if you're Jesus, presumably you'd want to stay at the highest club level going into the World Cup. He'd play on that right-hand side. As I understand it, he prefers to play there rather than through the middle. So I don't even think he would solve Arsenal's problems in terms of an orthodox centre-forward. And it's quite fascinating to see why that Arteta likes him. But for me, I'm not quite sure he's the answer. Well, I'm not talking in terms of scoring goals. His goal record's fine. I'm talking about in terms of the bigger picture of problems that they have.
He's obviously got a relationship with Mikel Arteta from when Arteta was the assistant at Manchester City. And maybe that might be the thing that sort of takes it over the edge and maybe gives Arteta the advantage over Antonio Conte. But and also the fact that with Harry Kane, Kulusevski, and Son in the team, you know, you're asking where does Jesus fit in? But it looks as if he's going to be on the move to one of those two North London clubs. Why do Chelsea want Raheem Sterling? And is he going to be a better fit for them than Lukaku? Because it seems now, Kevin, that there's growing confidence around Chelsea that he is going to be their big name summer signing, with Raheem Sterling reportedly out on England duty, talking to Chelsea players, asking them what life is like under Thomas Tuchel.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting because I think he's a top-class player. I think he's proven that with Manchester City year upon year. You can't stay in a Pep Guardiola squad for as long as he has and play as many games as he has if you're no good. And we know what he did for England at the European Championship. It was great that he thrived in that way. Going back to when he was at Liverpool, I've been a massive fan of his. I love how intelligent he is with his running. I like the fact that, yes, people will point to some of the incredible misses he's had in front of goal. What I love about him is that he gets up and he goes again, and then he'll keep trying to find those positions to score goals. He's incredibly intelligent. And I think he would suit Thomas Tuchel, actually, in the way that he plays, because he can play across that attacking line. I think the City thing is interesting because in the really key games last season, he wasn't picked in the starting 11. Yeah. And I think That does happen to all City players at some stage. Bernardo Silva was out and then he was in. Ilkay Gundogan was in, then he was out, and then he was back in for that Aston Villa game in the end and made such a difference. But I can understand why he would want to move on. He's a London boy, we know that. So this move does probably make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and also there is increased competition, and we'll get to Julian Alvarez as well a little bit later on because he's part of that. And Erling Haaland, meaning that it's a little bit clogged in that front battalion for Manchester City. And he wants to play regularly because, again, he wants to play at the World Cup for England, needs to be playing every single week. He isn't a goal scorer of the like of Haaland or of Mo Salah, but 131 goals in 339 appearances for Manchester City, where he hasn't often played through the middle, Darren, is not a bad return. And they don't need him to drop a link. They've got Mount, they've got Havertz for that. Do you think this works for Chelsea, this with Lukaku now seemingly on his way back to Inter?
Yeah, I think it does. He arrives as a winner, 4 Premier League titles. He can score goals, 13 goals in 30 Premier League appearances last season. And he joins a club that knows how to win as well. I've got to just say, while we've been on air, you might have seen me looking at the screen, Chelsea have announced Bruce Buck. This is Monday morning, obviously, we're recording this, and Chelsea have announced that Bruce Buck is going to step down at the end of the season, but he's going to stay around as an advisor to the club. But, you know, as a club, we all know that Chelsea know how to build a team to win silverware.
But Darren, even though they're announcing things like that, it does feel as if they're a little bit behind the curve in terms of transfer negotiations. Yes. And you do wonder, with all that going on behind the scenes, who's actually doing all that?
Well, the interesting thing was, I was at the final game, the Premier League game of this season, against Watford. And Thomas Tuchel said that he was asked if he was going to go on holiday. Now he said, no holiday for me, no sun lounger. I've got a list of targets. We're waiting for the takeover to be completed. And then we press the button on the targets that we have. And he'd drawn up that list of targets already. So he appears to have a clear idea of what he wants to do and how he wants to do it. He talked about having spoken to Todd Boehly, the new owner, and about Boehly being on board with what he wants to do. And we understand since then that he's been given the green light to reshape the club in his own image. The only thing that I do that does fascinate me about the pursuit of Raheem Sterling is that Chelsea have players in the wide positions already. Ziyech, Pulisic, Hudson-Odoi, Werner. The only thing set against that is that
none of them have delivered.
Exactly. And Sterling arrives as somebody who knows exactly how to deliver. And I would imagine he would arrive with a point to prove, given that he's into the last 12 months of his contract at City and there hasn't been any desperation. There probably has been a willingness, but not a desperation to keep him, such that he's received an offer that he's not able to refuse. So I think he could be a good fit for Chelsea.
I've got one plea.
As a man with a mission.
I've got one plea to Raheem Sterling. If you're listening, if you arrive at Chelsea and they say to you, you are here as our new frontline striker, please take the number 9 shirt. Just say no.
Yeah.
Whatever happens, absolutely. Just say no. Okay? That's all I'm going to say. You can go back and you can have a look through the annals of history. Do not wear it. Whatever you do, don't even look at it. Just get another shirt. Any shirt. Doesn't matter. Just don't touch that jersey. one striker who we might see more of next season is Julian Alvarez. And Kevin, you've been watching him.
Well, he's an interesting player. I mean, he's guys like Tim Vickery, who cover South America so deeply and so widely, have spoken highly of him for a long, long time. And this is a guy that just scores buckets of goals. His movement, I talked about Raheem Sterling's movement being really clever. He's too. He's obviously a very different player to Erling Haaland. I could see him really slotting into what Pep Guardiola wants from his players, in the sense that he has that intelligence, so he could take on board all of those patterns that Guardiola makes look like they are off the cuff, makes it look as though they just happen, but it's just time and time and time again on the training grounds, getting them drilled down. And he's the kind of player, even at a young age, who I think could take on board that information. He's dealt with the pressure of playing for an enormous football club like River Plate, and he's thrived in that. And the fact that City wanted to sign him ahead of time, but make sure he got game time by loaning him straight back, I think was really interesting. So,
Kev, he can play off the wide as well as in the centre.
Yeah, that's right.
How do you think they'll play?
I'm fascinated to see what they do with Haaland, because if you look at the way they play in general, they're very fluid in that front line, aren't they? But they like those kind of cutbacks into the area. I think what you'll get is Haaland likes to run in behind a lot. So we'll see whether that happens. But one thing I think people don't
Kevin, can it? Because they have so much of the ball, they never find themselves really in a situation there is space for him to run in behind.
That's it. But what I was going to say is that I think one of the facets of his game that people don't focus on so much, what they see on highlight reels and in games, is him running onto the ball in the channels or running through and in behind. And he's so powerful and he's so quick that he's devastating in those areas. But what he's also excellent at is movement in the penalty area.
Okay.
And he's the kind of guy that, with all of that domination City have and all of the balls that come into the penalty area, he can make that near post run. He can pull off the defender. He can find those pockets of space you need. And what he can do that some other players haven't been able to do for City on a regular basis is find the finish he needs. He's a brilliant finisher. So I think a guy like Alvarez could play in those wide areas. And I think Haaland will pick up the pieces in the penalty area. And that's what they don't have. And against the better teams, in transition, when City aren't dominating in the way that they normally do, that's when Haaland can come alive as well.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned that sort of, I always say that sort of FIFA 99 goal, which is you get hold of the ball, you run to the byline and then cut it back, and there's always someone there waiting to tap it in. That is the typical Manchester City goal, isn't it? They're great at doing that. And he's going to add to that because he can pull off a defender, find that space, and then we know he can finish. But how do you get... This is what fascinates me. Obviously, we're seeing Jesus and Sterling likely to leave. But how do you get Jack Grealish, Phil Foden, Kevin De Bruyne, Bernardo Silva, Julian Alvarez, Erling Haaland all into the same team? It's impossible, isn't it? There's going to be a heavy degree of rotation. Are the new signings going to be happy with that?
I think I said this right at the end of this season, that what we're seeing in the Premier League is a bit of an arms race, because I don't think we're talking about teams anymore. I think we're talking about squads.
Yeah.
I know, for example, at Spurs, Antonio Conte is building a squad where obviously Kane and Son apart, nobody can be guaranteed a first team place. Everybody in every game is working for their slot. Now, clearly he will have a clear idea about who he feels the best players are in any given 11. But I think it's very similar at Liverpool and at the City. I think that although they both have a plethora of options, nobody can take their place for granted. And that's as it should be, because they've got so much quality in both squads. But I think City have looked across the road at Liverpool and seen that they're tearing up their squad and they're going to go again. And they're trying to do the same thing. They've brought the average age down. They're not worried about losing experience because they've brought in quality. And I just think the whole process is fascinating to watch.
The physical demands now on squads, we talk about how many games there are. It's been such a long season, and then we went, here we go. Here's four Nations League game for you at the end of the season. So you've got this, we're going to have an expanded Champions League in 2024, whether we like it or not. So we're going to have this Swiss model. There are going to be more games. So teams have to. They have to have 25 who you could play in your biggest game of the season if you wanted to. And that cover and competition, I think Liverpool have done it brilliantly. I think City, as you say, Darren, have done a really good job of it. I think it's what Tuchel wants at Chelsea. He wants the, he's always been a guy that mixes and matches. He's always thought really deeply about the opposition. And he'll make 5-6 changes if he thinks it suits him and suits the team. So what he wants is not a set starting 11. I think that's gone. I think that idea now of, oh, well, he doesn't know what his best 11 is. Good. Because it means he's got lots of players who are competing for places. And I mean, I know I mentioned it already, but Bernardo Silva, I think, is a great example at Manchester City. It wasn't that long ago we were talking about him wanting to go to Atletico Madrid because he wasn't playing. But he knuckled down and he became a really important part of that team. And Mahrez has done the same. He's been in and out. So I think that's the way the top clubs are operating now.
Hi, I'm Leah Williamson.
Hi, I'm Millie Bright.
Hi, my name's Lotta Vibben-Moy.
Hi, this is Chloe Kelly.
And you're listening to the Women's Euros.
The Women's Euros.
The Women's Euros.
On TalkSport.
Downward header from Paris is blocked and then the shot is fired in by Williamson off the crossbar.
And Ellen White has tucked it in! And would you believe it?
Is Barisa going for goal and finding it? What a strike from Barisa! Cuts back onto her right foot and finds the net! Vivian Miedema! Starting as she means to go on.
It's so exciting. I can't tell you how excited everybody is and how much everybody just wants to be involved in this squad and this journey, really. I think a home Euros is a home tournament of any description, but a home Euros is up there with bucket list kind of things, isn't it, really?
I think just for women's football in this country, it's going to be huge. And obviously, we're going to be able to have loads of fans and hopefully inspire a lot of young girls and boys to keep playing football.
It may be festival season, but welcome to the main stage.
On the road to the Women's Euros, live on TalkSport.
In just 16 days, or maybe 15 by the time that you listen to or watch this podcast, the Women's European Championship kicks off at Old Trafford. England taking on Austria in their first game. Throughout the tournament, we will bring you all the action on TalkSport, and this pod will follow the tournament all the way through as well. So we thought we would start by giving you an overview of what to expect. I mean, you may not watch the WSL every week or may not have followed England too much before, but the coverage is expanding and easier to follow and to find than ever. And joining us to talk about it is Flo Lloyd-Hughes. Hello.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good, thank you. Thank you very much for coming on the pod. I suppose the first sort of question is, from my perspective of the situation, England are contenders to win this European Championship. And I think we sometimes say that and then everybody gets over ambitious and starts to expect England to do well. But let's be completely clear. After their showings at the last three tournaments, we should be expecting a little bit more of this team that started to develop under their new manager.
I think so, yeah. Obviously, it's a home tournament, so there's always going to be a bit of expectation, a bit of pressure because of that anyway. And then I think you add to that that they have made semi-final the last two major tournaments, got to semi-finals in the World Cup in, or last three actually, World Cup in 2019, Euros in 2017. And then obviously they won the third place playoff in the World Cup in 2015. So they are yet to get to that final again. They have been to the final of a Euros before and lost in a final, but they are yet to win a major tournament. So that is the real pressure this year. And I think with the new coach, Serena Wiegmann, I think there is reason, a lot of good reason to be excited and realistic as well about their prospects and it not to just be the fact that it's a home tournament. There's obviously going to be a lot of hype around it.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of competition as well. England, eighth in the world as far as the rankings are concerned, but five of the seven teams that are above them are from Europe. So that probably gives us an indication of how competitive it's going to be, doesn't it?
Yeah, the continent is stacked with good teams at the moment. I think Sweden are probably the out-and-out favourites to win the competition, really, if you look at all of those teams. I think they're the ones who probably do have the best chance and probably have the most pressure alongside England because they did very well at the Olympic Games. They've been improving. They beat England in the third-place playoff in the 2019 World Cup, absolutely blew them away. They have been similarly on a kind of very upward trajectory and they've been sort of classically known for quite a defensive, robust style. But in the Olympic Games, we saw them add a little bit more flair and creativity with their game, which also adds a new threat. And I think people have sort of seen that and thought, oh, wow, Sweden have leveled up a little bit. And I think there's a lot of expectation for them to go to the finals of this summer's championship. So I think they're probably England's kind of closest rivals. And depending what happens with the draw and who wins what group, England could potentially face Spain quite early on in the tournament. But Spain, I don't think, are going to win the tournament, but I think they're still going to be a team that's hard to beat. They're not Barcelona. That is the reality. They're a very good team, but they're not Barcelona. They've lost one of their strikers recently through injury. And like a kind of any classic Spain team, they have a lot of the ball, a lot of possession, but they do struggle to create chances and score goals. So I think that, you know, could end up being their downfall. So there are a lot of teams who are good, but there aren't actually that many teams who are the ruthless winners that you need to see at a major tournament.
Yeah, England did a particularly good job tactically against Spain in the Arnold Clark Cup against them when they restricted them and it finished 0-0. I think Williamson played in midfield in that game alongside Kira Walsh, wasn't it, in that game? And they nullified the Spanish attack. Look, let's talk a little bit about the attacking talent that England have got, because they've got, Kevin, quite a few young upcoming players. This is a real good mix, actually, of old heads. People like Stokes, Bronze, Scott, Bright, White and Kirby who have been around for a very, very long time. And some young attacking talent as well. Chloe Kelly of Manchester City on the right-hand side. Lauren Hemp, who has been terrific in the WSL, on the left.
Yeah, I was at the FA Cup final, and Lauren, I love a winger. I love a winger who'll just run at people, and Lauren Hemp, I thought, was absolutely outstanding. And, you know, you would think if she could take that kind of form into this tournament and really shine. Chloe Kelly, I think, is back from long-term injury recently. So yeah, you've got that ability to play them out wide and stretch teams. And I was going to ask Flo, actually, what's been the curve like with Lauren Hemp? Has there been like a huge improvement? Has she suddenly gone up a gear? Or are these the kind of performances she's been putting in for quite a while?
I think she's for the last couple of years, she's been playing at a very good level. I mean, she's won the PFA Young Player of the Year award like three or four times in a row. It's ridiculous. I don't know when you kind of graduate after you've won it a few times. I feel like you shouldn't be eligible for that award anymore, no matter your age, because it seems a bit silly now that no one else gets a chance really for that one. But I do think this season she has really, really stepped up a level. She's always been a very exciting talent. She missed a bit of last season through injury. But since she's come back from that injury this season, from kind of start to finish, she's just been unplayable at times. And that's obviously very good news for England. And I think you're right, Kevin. I think the fact that Chloe Kelly's coming back and finding form quite quickly after having that ACL injury is really impressive, because I do think what teams have done against Man City this season is very much focused on shutting down the Lauren Hemp threat. And when they do that, City didn't really have other options. So it's really important that England don't fall into that trap as well. I think Serena Bigman is a better coach than Gareth Taylor and has more options at her disposal and is more creative with the way that she plays with England. But I think having Chloe Kelly down that right-hand side and Beth Mead as well, who's had a very good season, I think that's going to be so good for England, because at times it's going to be so hard for teams to control and defend against them because they've just got so many options.
Flo, I was going to ask you about Serena anyway. She was with the Netherlands when they won the Euro 2017 and she was runners-up. She was with them when they were runners-up at the World Cup 2019. Now she's with England. A lot being said about her. From what you can see, what has she brought to the England team?
I think she's a brilliant coach, first and foremost. I think it's felt like a long time since England had a coach who's very good at coaching, who knows football. You know, she was one of the first women in the world, I think, to get a pro license. So she's a very, very experienced coach. She's coached with men's teams. She's obviously been the head coach of women's teams. She's very good at what she does. And I think one of the things that she's probably the best at in women's football is reading the game and being able to change the situations. I mean, I think Thomas Tuchel is one of the best coaches in the world at doing that, at being able to read a situation and then bring the changes required required to get a grip at the game or win the game or whatever it may be. And I think Serena Wiegmann, she's maybe not quite as good as him at that, but she's very good at that. And England, I think that's where they struggled in the past, is making the right substitutions. I think we saw in the Belgium game just a few days ago when England was struggling to really break through Belgium, who were, it was very organised, set up very well. She made some changes at half time and England blew them away in the second half. And I think that's what she's really good at. I think that will be really important as well, especially at a home tournament where, say, you go in 0-0 in a quarter final game and you've got the crowd getting a little bit nervous, getting a little bit, you know, getting a little bit touchy. And I think it's very important for you to be able to kind of get a grip on the game, make those substitutions to then show that ruthlessness and that confidence. And I think bring that mentality. And then outside of that, I think she's been a very impressive person. She's got that sort of, I think, typical Dutch style where she's very matter of fact. You know, she's very polite, she's very funny, but she's also very matter of fact. She doesn't mince her words. I mean, in the press conference after she announced the Euro squads, you know, lots of questions about Steph Horton. And she said very, you know, very clearly, yeah, Steph wasn't happy. She was very angry about it. Now, not many coaches would say that. They would probably be very political, very polite and say, oh, you know, it was a hard conversation, but, you know, she took it well. But Serena just, she says what she means. She's very honest. She's very open. And I think that's brilliant. And then she matches that with, you know, great coaching ability as well.
Yeah, that was a big talking point, wasn't it? That Steph Horton wasn't in the team, but she hadn't really played a game since January and she's had an Achilles injury, so it can't be that much of a surprise. However, Fran Kirby hasn't played much football either, but she has been included, which raised one or two eyebrows. It'd be interesting where she fits into the team with all that attacking talent that England already have at their disposal. One of the problems they had, I think, particularly when they were ripped apart by the USA in Lyon, was defensively. And the makeup of the defence is really key, isn't it? What happens with Leah Williamson? Is she going to play in midfield or is she going to play at centre-half? Who then partners Millie Bright? And if that is the case, does Alex Greenwood play at centre-half like she's been doing for Manchester City? Because she's been a key player for Gareth Taylor's team, especially in the second half of the season. And her set-piece delivery is sensational, Flo.
Yeah, I think the best combination for England, and Serena Wiegmann has played this combination a fair bit, would be Alex Greenwood on the left-hand side centre-back position, then Millie Bright on the right. It is a luxury in football to have a naturally left-sided centre-back. There's not a lot of them in the game. We obviously know that's why Tyrone Mings is sometimes favoured for England as well. It is a luxury. So I feel like that's why Serena Wiegmann will go with that partnership, and they've played well together. And then that leaves Demi Stokes to play at left-back. I think she is probably one of the weaker links for England. She's a very pragmatic player, but she's very risk averse. And I think that limits them a little bit going forward. She's obviously very experienced that position, but she's also not as quick because she's, you know, a little bit older now. So we may see someone like Rachel Daly, who plays in an attacking position for her club, but has played at right back for England. She may play at left back.
Serena Wiegmann's done that before, hasn't she? She's played.
Yeah, she's done that a couple times now. And because she is a forward player, she's very aggressive going forward. So I think against some of the sort of weaker opposition, if you want to call that, maybe against Austria and Northern Ireland, we will see maybe Rachel Daly play at left back, because I think England can take a few more risks in that. And then I think we'll see Williamson and Walsh perhaps play in midfield in front of the back four.
There's been quite a few movements as far as the England players are concerned just before the start of the tournament. There's quite a big gap between the FA Cup final and the start of the European Championship, which I think is quite good. A lot of them went to the West Coast of America. Actually, a lot of them went together to the West Coast of America, and they had a real break before they joined up with the Lionesses. But in between time, Lucy Bronze has joined Barcelona. Bayern Munich have snapped up Georgia Stanway as well. Is there anybody else that could be distracted by things that are going on domestically?
I think it should be fairly quiet now. The only sort of question mark is the potential rumours around Kira Walsh maybe moving from City as well. I think she's been linked to a move to Real Madrid potentially, where Caroline Weir is also potentially heading. So I think she's probably the only one in the England camp at the moment who has a real question mark over her future. I think everyone else seems fairly settled, and people weren't sure whether Lucy Bronze was going to announce her next move before the tournament or after the tournament. So that's sort of out the way. I think that deal had been done a week or so ago, but that no one was actually sure where she was going. She said, you know, I've signed my new deal and a new club, but there were rumors that she might be going to the States or she might be going to Real Madrid. And she surprised everyone really by heading to Barcelona. But I think it should be okay in terms of rumors and you know, storylines, because really Lucy Bronze was the real free agent that everyone was sort of whispering about, where's she going. And now that's done, I think, you know, there'll be fewer distractions really.
Flo, I was going to ask about those moves actually, but in a different sense. Georgia Stanway making the move to Bayern, we know they're one of the biggest clubs in Germany, although not as dominant, of course, in women's football as they are in men's football. But Lucy Bronze has played for Lyon for a long time, gained experience there, is going to go to Barcelona. We know what they've done on the continental stage. We've got players in the States as well. How has that changed the picture? Have all of those experiences really helped those players, and experience of playing different leagues?
I think so, yeah. I mean, this start of this season, I don't think there were any... Rachel Daly was the only player who didn't play in England. Previously, you had Nikita Paris in Lyon, Alex Greenwood spent some time in Lyon, obviously Lucy Bronze was in Lyon, Tony Duggan spent some time in the Spanish leagues, Izzy Christian was in Lyon, Duggan and Christian aren't involved in England at the moment. And maybe, you know, who knows if they will manage to find their way back into the squad. But I do think it certainly helped them. I think, especially with someone like Rachel Daly, because, I mean, who knows where she would be playing positionally if she didn't play for the Houston Dash in the States. And she's their record goal scorer. And, you know, she's such an important part of their team. They absolutely love her over there. I think it's given her massive confidence playing over there. And I'm sure she's had lots. I mean, she's done loan spells over here, but I'm sure she's had lots of offers to come back over here permanently. But she absolutely loves playing in the US League. So I think it is really important. I think Georgia Stanway, I think, will really thrive playing in a different league. I think it is hard, obviously, for someone like her when you've spent your whole career playing in England, and also such a long part of that. I think she made her debut for City when she was like 15 or 16. So that's really tough. But her boyfriend plays rugby league in France, so she's a little bit closer to him now as well. So I think she's going to really thrive, and I'm really excited for, you know, some of these players taking what could be a bit of a risk and, you know, really, I think, developing their game.
What's happened to Nikita Paris?
It's a great question. I mean, I thought she was one of the players who was potentially really at risk of dropping out of the England squad. It's not been a good season for her. I think she's potentially a bit lucky that when she has played under Serena Bigman, she's actually played quite well in the sort of short burst that we've seen from her. She does offer something a little bit different on the right-hand side. And I think she has impressed under Serena Bigman. But when it comes to Arsenal, I don't think she's really found her place in that team. I think she, you know, she struggled to find form. She struggled to get consistent game time. She did score a few goals in their Champions League qualifying games. But yeah, it's not been a great season for her. I think there are quite a few England players, I think, who are in that sort of awkward age where if you were someone who built your game on pace, and I think Lucy Bronze is someone like this as well. If you're someone who built your game on pace and a bit of physicality and aggressiveness, when you reach that kind of like late 20s, early 30s point in your career, it's really hard to find what you do because you don't have that edge anymore. And I think Lucy Bronze is in that place. I think Debbie Stokes is in that place a little bit. I think Nikita Paris is in that place a little bit. I think you're sort of in limbo because you're trying to work out how you can still beat players and how you can still take on players. And I think this Euros is going to be really interesting for some of those sorts of players, because in the World Cup, we saw them thrive at like their actual sort of age peak as a footballer. Yeah. And now a few years on, it's like, right, what do I do? How do I play? How do I adapt? And I think in some of these games we've seen from Lucy Bronze in England shirt recently, she's been taking a lot of risks. And I think it's kind of a bit of a sort of a reality check of like, where am I now in relation to some of the other best players around the world?
At least we won't be having the debate about where Lucy Bronze plays this major tournament. Is Phil Neville going to play her in midfield, which was very much the dominant conversation ahead of 2019. And it won't be as hot as it was in Lyon in the latter stages of the World Cup 3 years ago. But all the commentaries are live on TalkSport. England and Northern Ireland games, every single one of them, plus the semi-finals and the finals, are all on TalkSport. Flo is part of our team, and we're very excited about it, aren't we, Flo? So we look forward to bringing you that live on TalkSport. Cheers, Flo.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers, Flo.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. There's a lot more to those 90 minutes than what goes down on the pitch. With the latest odds, form guides and expert opinions, you'll know the score with Ladbrokes. Odds update on Talk Sport with Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org. T's and C's apply.
Okay, Eddie Nketiah has been given the iconic Thierry Henry number 14 shirt, Darren. 23 goals in 92 appearances. His chances have been few and far between, to be fair. He's 23. Maybe he should be further along now, but Thierry Henry's number? Good idea, bad idea? What do you reckon? I know I'm obsessed with numbers. I know Raheem don't wear the nine. I'm not entirely
I think you're right to be obsessed. I talk a lot, as you know, but I think with this one, it's very simple. I think he is absolutely crazy.
Yes, I agree with you. I mean, why would you do it? You're piling pressure on yourself, right, Kev?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, in one way, it shows bravado and it shows confidence. And if it works out, then great. But you're never going to hit that level. Eddie Nketiah, bless him, is never going to be Thierry Henry. So I do think it's unnecessary pressure, to be honest. And I wonder where that's really come from.
I mean, Edu's got a picture of him sort of handing it over and it's all like big, smiley and wonderful. And you're like, yeah, but guys, the poor kid... You've only just about signed him on a new contract. You didn't give him any game time until the end of last season when you had nobody else. So, like, you know, are we sure this is the right sort of thing to do after maybe next year when he scored 20 goals
in
the Premier League? Then you might want to do it, but now?
But you just dial down the background noise at this point of your career. He needs to focus on being really, really good for Arsenal and justifying the new contract. I mean, it wasn't that long ago he was nearly going to Palace and that fell through. And so, you know, credit to him for digging in and kind of convincing Mikel Arteta. But, you know, if they'd have got in Dusan Vlahovic, which was never going to happen, I don't think, but if they had, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So I do think it's a strange one. I do.
I looked at the news around that, and I looked at it in the same way that I looked at that video footage of the guy on the plane who was trying to antagonize Mike Tyson.
Yeah.
And you know, you're thinking, what are you doing? You know? Well, I kind of looked at it in the same way. I think there's nothing for me to add. I think it makes perfect sense. I'm going to be quiet now.
West Ham signed centre-back Naif Agird from Rennes. He's already said his goodbyes. He's going to cost around 30 million quid. Is that a position, Darren, that West Ham need to strengthen?
Absolutely, yes. They had a real centre-half problem towards the latter stages of their season, partly because Craig Dawson was suspended, mostly because their other centre-halves were injured. David Moyes likes to build from the back. He's also in for David Rom at Hoffenheim, a really good young left full-back who has one of the highest assist makers in the Bundesliga last season. Sorry for stepping on your toes with this, Kevin, because I know
this is a perfect pricey of David Ram.
but I think he adds considerably more than both Arthur Matsuaku, who is decent but not quite good enough. And Aaron Cresswell, who was sent off twice in the Europa League campaign. He's an honest player. We know what he brings, but I think Dave Rom is a level up, and it's the reason why Newcastle, Manchester United and several Dortmund, as I understand it, are in for him as well. David Rom and Egerd. And just a little bit about him. He helped Morocco get to the World Cup finals in Qatar, beat Congo on the way there. He's been a really consistent performer for his club. And you would imagine him alongside Zouma at the heart of West Ham's defence will be a really good partnership to move forward as far as West Ham are concerned, because David Moyes is very, very set on making sure that he's got an established back four. And as I say, there are injury concerns around the other players. Craig Dawson, nothing wrong with him. Good on his pro, but I think Egerd is a level up.
Yep. Steve Cooper's about to sign a new contract at Nottingham Forest. That's an important development. So is the fact that they're probably going to get Dean Henderson in the door as the goalkeeper. And Brennan Johnson looks like he's going to sign a new contract, and that will be massive for them.
Yeah, he's been hugely exciting for them, not just in the Championship. I was really impressed with him for Wales in the recent internationals. I thought he looked great finisher. The way he took a couple of his goals, superb. I think what's really interesting about Forrest, actually, is some of the straying back to the Bundesliga, as I'll always try and get the conversation to go to Teutonic matters. But they've been linked with a couple of Bundesliga players who were excellent, actually, potentially for a newly promoted team. So Moussa Niakate, who's a left-sided centre-back who's been really good for Mainz, quiet leader, good on the ball, physical, difficult to get past, doesn't make many mistakes, only got a year left on his deal at Mainz. And then Taiwo Awoniyi, who is a Nigerian centre-forward who's done ever so well for Union Berlin. And he's a guy that can be a really good focal point in attack for them, can bring other players in. I think he's an excellent player.
We don't talk about Union Berlin on this podcast. No. Only Hertha.
As a Hertha fan, that but quiet booing. They used to be friends, Hertha and Union.
Not anymore, though. We used to be. In fact, all the Berlin clubs used to be quite friendly until Union got anywhere near promotion. But you want some good news, Kev? And I wonder, actually, if you want to come with me for this. But Hertha are going to play both Nottingham Forest and Derby in July in England.
This is exciting.
Did you know that?
And they'll do it as a Bundesliga club. And they did everything they could to make sure they didn't do it as a Bundesliga club. But they just about got there.
The worst thing they did was they appointed Felix Magath as their manager for the last 6 weeks of the season. And everyone just went, oh, no. Oh, no, why have you done that? And actually, it worked. So well done to him. So I'll be going to those games. I'm very excited about it. Okay, big splash this weekend was that Jack Grealish is in Las Vegas. Towers of £5,000 a night suites, an 80 grand splurge and 116 bottles of champagne, clubbing, brunettes, a pool party. Some might ask, do we really care that Jack is on the lash in Vegas? Others will say this is the reason he didn't set the world alight with Manchester City in England last season. Where are we on this, Darren? I mean, as I declare a little bit of an interest here, as someone who is about to go on the lash in Vegas, I'm not going to criticise him too much. But
is this our pod's version of Partygate? Listen, the last thing young footballers need is older guys like us basically telling them how they should spend their free time.
Especially when you copy them.
Yeah, well, quite, especially when you copy them. Yes, indeed.
He didn't do anything wrong. He's just having a bit of downtime.
Absolutely. He's having downtime. I just think two things. A, footballers should be aware that managers are always watching them. I've been in press conferences where I've heard managers speak about other players and their holiday exploits.
But Darren, he obviously doesn't care about that because he got absolutely bladdered on a bus in front of Pep Guardiola.
Absolutely. But, you know, just like us in our jobs, we'd be quite naive to think the boss isn't watching. you know, and we may say it's our downtime, and we may say, well, you know, you'd be quite right. It's your that's why I'm quite loath to kind of wave my finger at Jack, because he's a young man, he's living the dream, he's having fun. Who am I to tell him what he should and shouldn't do? I'm just saying, in the context of this, managers are always watching, always.
Yeah, Kevin.
That's a disturbing idea, isn't it?
Well, I'll tell you very quickly, Kevin.
Idea.
If you look at Gareth Southgate, there are one or two players who are not in his squad because he is concerned about the way that they let their hair down. Yeah. It's not a secret. And as I say, managers, they might not be public about it. They might, you know, address whatever they need to in private, but they are always watching. And some managers, you know, sometimes as a player, and this doesn't just go for Premier League players, it goes for across Europe. Some players look at, when clubs sign some players, they look at what they are like.
Yeah, of course.
In the dressing room, on the pitch, away from the dressing room, in their downtime. They look at all of that bigger picture. And that's all I'm saying. The rest is up to him.
So the story goes, when Thomas Tuchel first arrived in Paris, one of the first things he did was he rung up the managers of all of the local nightclubs and restaurants to find out who was going in there and trying to strike up a relationship with them and find out who was clubbing and when, which is a very Thomas Tuchel thing to do.
There's quite a lot of nightclubs and restaurants in Paris. I mean, that is some job, isn't it? I mean,
he's a very thorough guy.
You're thumbing through a very big yellow pages there.
Yeah, that's the kind of lengths Tuchel will go to make sure he's in control of every situation. I have no problem with the Grealish thing. Good luck to him. If it's legal, it's fine. So I don't think there's a big problem.
Mr. Tuchel, I have the manager of the Pink Flamingo on the phone for you.
The worst thing is a good job my boss doesn't do that sort of phoning around. Or Alex Crook's boss, because, you know... We certainly.
You wouldn't have time. You'd run out of time to make all those calls.
I was going to say, you need a few yellow pages for that. Right. Okay, gents, thank you very much for getting involved in the pod today. I'm not back Thursday because I'll be trying to. I'll probably get on the coattails of Jack Grealish actually and join that £80,000 splurge on 116 bottles of champagne, if I'm completely honest. I heard that there's a few other players that are out there as well, so I'll be trying to hunt them down and get into their parties because there's no way I'm paying for it. I will see. You'll be with, I think you're both with Alex Crook, or certainly you are, Darren. No, you're not, because you're partying as well this weekend, because you're youthful and cool. You're going to Glastonbury.
I am going to Glastonbury, yes. So I shall have a party of my own in a field with a lot of mud involved. So hopefully that will be a lot of fun. The weather looks okay at the moment, so fingers crossed.
Just to reiterate, it is Glastonbury. He isn't just going to any field and having a party with loads of mud.
No. That's what I'm doing the week after that. Yeah, exactly.
Remember, Kevin, the bosses are always watching. Right, always. That's it. Thank you very much for downloading the Game Day podcast from TalkSport. Remember, the European Championships starts on the 6th of July. Every single England game is live.
The Premier League All Access podcast is proud to be brought to you by Ladbrokes. The latest odds? We set them. Form guides? We've got them. Expert opinions? We share them. The best fans in the world deserve the best. Be match day ready before the whistle blows with Ladbrokes. Odds update on Talk Sport with Ladbrokes. Are you in? Let's go. Play at ladbrokes.com. 18 plus. BeGambleAware.org. T's and C's apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.